Energy Environment to order.
The woman.
We're doing this first.
Perfect. Yep.
Okay. Well, welcome, folks. The first order of business today is to hold some work sessions on House Bill 2295, which is the Water Resources Department's proposed fee increase for their transactional division, and House Bill 2296, which increases fees for do-it-yourself home drinking water wells. Beth, you want to give us a little rundown on 2295 to start us out?
Mr. Chair and committee members, House Bill 2295 was heard on 213. For the record, there's a fiscal impact statement issued and available on OLIS. The House Bill 2295 itself increases the fees for certain Water Resource Department services and eliminates the fee for reductions scheduled for July 1st, 2017.
Yeah. I'm going to open a work session on 2295 at this time. Go ahead.
Okay.
I'll entertain a motion at this time.
Okay. Chair Helm, I move House Bill 2295 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Representative Power moves House Bill 2295 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there a discussion? Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize that I haven't done the study I probably should have done. And the answer is probably obvious. What is the purpose of the referral to the Ways and Means? Maybe a staff question.
Yes.
Mr. Chair and Representative Barnhart and committee. So the subsequent referral to the bill was added on originally just because you're making adjustments with the fee levels, and so Ways and Means would like to have that to be considered.
And they do that routinely on this sort of bill.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart.
I'm getting
Barnhart.
A head nod from Representative Colby. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be supporting the bill today, but for purposes of the discussion in Ways and Means, there's a couple of issues that need attention. I think they were one was raised for sure in the hearing we had earlier, and that was the support, I think, was qualified that these fees can go up, but if there are other fees coming, then the support would wane dramatically because these fees are challenging in and of themselves, necessary, but still not to be viewed in isolation. The second issue I chose not to raise in the hearing, but it should be discussed, is that there had been a 4-year sunset on these to heighten everyone's awareness of the challenge these kinds of fees impose upon those paying them. It happens that this only extends those fees for 4 years, so I chose not to raise it there, but I'm not sure I gave it the verbal attention it needed, so I'm doing so now. But and then I think those issues will be raised in Ways and Means, so I'm happy for that that additional conversation. But I will be supporting the bill today.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Is there further discussion? Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will not be supporting the bill today just because my constituents can't take any more fees without I need to see some sort of structural change in the organization, because I'm afraid we'll be back here in 4 years needing more fee increases and then 4 years after that. So when we grant something like that, but there's no structural change in how they do business or what they do, it concerns me because it's an ever-ending ask. And I know my constituents who are going to bear the brunt of a lot of this can't. And so I just want to be on the record that without any structural changes, and I don't think this has a sunset on it, if I'm correct. It's just extends. I'd love to see a sunset put on it for another 4 years. But those are my reasons.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. 2 points here. Representative Bentz made my first one in that, yes, there are stakeholders who are being ambivalent about this bill, but they are concerned about other potential fee increases coming, and I know you're pledging to work with those folks with some of their concerns, so I appreciate that. Secondly, I did want to go back to one of the points that the department made in requesting the fee increase, which is an increase in personnel cost of their agency, which is also in part attributable to certain cost drivers, i.e. PERS and so forth. So I just hope that as we go through this session that every fee-based agency isn't coming here asking for their fee related to personnel costs for that reason. So, but I'll support the bill.
Thank you. I also wanted to mention, more of a matter of information, we had a number of questions from committee members to the department, and they did provide answers, and that letter's been posted on the list. Any further discussion? Okay, seeing none, will the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative Benz?
Aye.
Representative Bloom?
Excused.
Representative Holby?
Aye.
Representative Breschke?
No.
Representative Boxman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Johnson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Power?
Aye.
Chair Holmes?
Aye. The motion passes. Very good. I'm going to move on now. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2296. And if staff will just give us a brief review of this as well.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2296 also has a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. You heard this bill on 215. House Bill 2296 as is would establish an application process and fee when a well requires deviation from the standards. The act also increases the landowner permit application fee and increases bond requirements. You do have a -1 amendment available on OLIS that was discussed at the hearing that would remove the language establishing the application process from the measure. It's a fiscal impact statement issued, and it is available on OLIS.
Okay. Is there anything more to say about the -1 amendment? This okay. Very good. Then at this time, I'll invite a motion on House Bill 2296.
Chair Helm, I move to adopt the -1 amendments dated February 15th, 2017.
Representative Power moves to adopt the -1 amendments dated 2015, 2017. Is there any discussion? If there's no further discussion, is there any objection?
Yeah, I'm a no.
No. Let me just call on you. Representative Breschke.
Yeah, I'm going to vote no.
On the amendment?
On the amendment. Okay. No, I'm sorry. You're doing the amendment, then let the amendment go.
Okay, we'll wait.
All right.
Very good. Without further objection or discussion, is there any objection to the -1 amendment? Seeing none, it is adopted. And then I'll take a motion on the bill as amended.
Chair Helm, I move HB 2296 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Representative Power moves House Bill 2296 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any further discussion? Representative Breschke.
No, that same issues as before. So okay. It's 2295. So.
Okay. Thank you. Any further discussion on this bill? Very good. Will the clerk call the roll then?
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative Benz?
Aye.
Excused.
Representative Holby?
Aye.
Representative Breschke?
No.
Representative Boxman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Johnson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Power?
Aye.
Chair Helm?
Aye. The motion passes and the bill will be sent as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means. With that, I'm closing the work session on those two bills. At this time, I would like committee to introduce committee bills, and I think that there is a list for you on our agenda today. By and large, these are placeholder bills that I asked LC to develop in case we need them as we move along through our work. You'll see the description for LC 3843 through the list to 3968 request a task force on various issues, and those are meant to be not to be task force but necessarily but to be placeholders. LC 2907 is relating to transportation electrification. It is a bill that Representative Barnhart asked to be made a committee bill. and LC 3652 is relating to energy efficiency standards for battery charger systems. This is something that the committee, the members that have been here in prior sessions are familiar with. There are energy efficiency standards that are kept by the Oregon Department of Energy by rule. There was an oversight, and this particular type of component of cell phones was left off the rule-making list, and we need to now make a fix by statute. So I thought that was appropriate for a committee bill. And I'll make the following qualifier that that we've heard before in other committees, that a vote for the introduction of a committee bill is not a vote on the merits of the content of the concept, nor does it guarantee the draft will be referred back to this committee or that it will be scheduled for a hearing. And with that, I'm going to open a work session on, I'm just going to open a work session on the introduction of committee measures that I'm going to read now. LC 2907, LC 3652, LC 3843, LC 3845, LC 3860, LC 3961, LC 3966, and LC 3968. And at this time, I'll entertain a motion.
Chair Helm, I move that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. LC 2907, dated 1-5-2017. LC 3652, dated 2-14-2017. LC 3843, dated 1-23-17. LC 3845, dated 1-23-2017. LC 3860, dated 1-23-2017. LC 3961, dated 1-23-2017. LC 3966, dated 1-23-2017. And LC 3968, dated 2-13-2017.
Representative Power moves that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills: LC 2907, dated 1-5-2017, LC 3652, dated 2-14-2017, LC 3843, dated 1-23-2017, LC 3845, dated 1-23-2017, LC 3860, dated 1-23-2017, LC 3961, dated 1-23-2017, LC 3966, dated 1-23-2017, and LC 3968, dated 2-13-2017. Is there any discussion on any of these bills? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to thank you and Beth for providing the context for the legislative concepts so we understand what they're about and we understand who's requested them. So look forward to supporting them.
Very
without
good.
The caveat that we necessarily will support them.
Yes.
Ultimately.
Very good. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You noted that I brought LC 2907 to your attention. I wanted to note that we're trying to continue working on the issue of transportation electrification. It is possible that this bill overlaps with or may interact with the coal to clean bill as it relates to electric vehicle chargers, but I thought it was important enough to bring it so that we could have the conversation about whether that's the case or not. And of course, the deadline is Tuesday for doing that. So I appreciate the committee's willingness to introduce this bill as a committee bill. This is one of those situations where an idea is useful, whether the person who actually had the LC drafted supports it or not will depend upon the conversation.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Barnhart. Any further discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection to adopting these as committee bills? If not, the measures are introduced as committee bills. With that, we can move on to some public hearings. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2330. And you want to give us a brief overview, Beth?
Mr. Chair and Committee Members, in 2013, the legislature enacted Senate Bill 536, which authorizes state agency to make an electric vehicle charging facility available on an agency property. House Bill 2330 changes some language to permit rather than require a state agency to set a price for using an EV charger installed on that on the agency's premise.
Very good. At this time, then, I'm going to invite Lindsay Baker forward to testify. Go ahead when you're ready.
Good afternoon, Chair Hellman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Lindsay Baker, and I am the Director of Government Relations at the Department of Administrative Services. To House Bill 2330. As Beth indicated, this the genesis of this was a bill that was passed by the legislature in the 2013 session, Senate Bill 536, which indeed authorized us, DAS, to install and to operate electric vehicle charging stations that would be available for use by our public employees and by members of the public at large. When this bill was passed, the calculation was set in statute, or the factors for consideration for the final end cost, the consumer cost of the electricity, required that we shall consider any cost that we accrued in providing that electricity. It has been the case in our experience, so we own a couple of them and operate a couple of them. A lot of them, the stations are operated by the Department of Transportation as well. And when that calculation is made, oftentimes, as an example, the real estate of where the actual facility, the station sits, is required to be considered in that calculation. This sort of, I don't want to say artificially inflates the price, but it does make it such that these stations are not really competitive, and so it disincents their use. And so we are requesting that we be allowed to consider those costs, but not required to consider those costs, so they can be more marketable to both the public and to public employees. If we have any questions, we are happy to answer questions.
Committee members, you have questions? Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what costs have you been considering for the purpose of setting the price for electricity currently, and which costs might you then ignore if we pass this bill? Now,
Chair,
you already mentioned one, the property that the charger sits on. What are the others?
Sure. So, Chair Hellman, Representative Barnhart, I will now defer to our technical expert. This is Brian King. I'll have him introduce himself for the record, who's our fleet and parking manager, who really is the expert on all of these issues.
Chair Helm, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brian King. I'm the Fleet and Parking Services Manager for the Department of Administrative Services. The answer to your question, Representative Barnhart, is that the way that we're interpreting it is it includes all the administration costs, the real estate costs, any installation costs for putting the systems in, and, of course, the cost of the electricity itself.
And how does this bill change that, if it does?
It allows us to make some judgment calls to recover as much of that as we can, however, to also make it equitable in the market so that it is more readily available to the public and to employees.
Great, thank you. The follow-up is slightly different. In the places where these chargers are located, do you charge for employees for parking?
Chair Helm, Representative Barnhart, yes, we do. We charge them for parking, and right now in policy, we've set at least a minimum charge of $20 per month for full-day charging or $10 per month for half-day charging. So we are recovering that for now. When we put in new systems, like Lindsay talked about, as we get into more costs to install, that cost can go up if we have to recover all of it.
Ah, thank you. I now understand the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for coming. So are the property costs, are they real costs? Are they real costs that you incur, or are they just assumed costs? I mean, what I'm asking is if I decided to start my own recharging station, Reschke's recharging stations, and I had to purchase the property and everything, would I have to then pass that on to the consumer, or is that something that I get deferred because of some state tax credit or something like that?
Chair Helm, Representative Reschke, the bill only affects state agencies. Mm-hmm. So it was only for what we have to recover. It wouldn't affect a private citizen.
But it is a real property cost. It's something you have to incur as an administration.
Yes.
Okay, but you're just not going to pass that along to the consumer.
If as it stands, we would have to include that in the cost of what we're doing.
Today, but
yes.
This bill would free you from doing that.
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I got two items. I do note that the bill declares an emergency, which wouldn't make me vote against the bill, but I just thought I'd note that. But I do have a question in Section 1, actually on page 2 of the bill. And I kind of hate to ask this question, but I feel like I need to. The word shall has been changed to may, which is a common practice, but in this particular case, it appears to me that the bill would allow the state agency to subsidize the operations of a private entity the way the bill's written with that may. I don't know that if that's the intent or not, and as well as that, they could, the agency could also substantially exceed the cost to the state agency of making the electricity available to the public. I don't know that that was the intent of the bill or whether legislative counsel can straighten that out for me, but in this particular case, changing that shall from a may, I'm not sure is the right way to do this.
Chair, Representative Holby, I'm not sure how to comment on that one because I'm not an expert on it. The intent for this was that we would just be, may take that option, but not. The intention is not to subsidize as much as possible. We want to recover as much as we can.
And if I could jump in as well, Chair Hellman, Representative Colby, if there's alternate language that would achieve what we are attempting to accomplish here that is not reflected in the introduced version, we would be more than happy to work with legislative counsel or whoever that would be to make sure that the conversation we're having here is reflected in the ultimate draft.
Right, and that's just what I was follow up. That's just what I was trying to clarify is what your intent was with that. So your intent is not to subsidize the operations of a private entity, I'm assuming.
Chair Helmer, that correct.
So you know, Mr. Chair, I just submit that to you and the committee administrator. I think there would be an easy language change to clarify that. Though legislative counsel may disagree with me, but I don't like the change from shall to may in that particular use.
I agree. Can I ask you that, thank you for those comments, Representative Holby and Representative Johnson. Can I ask you then before we move forward with this bill, if we do, to come back with some alternative language? And if you will work with Representative Holby's office to, and any other member of the committee that's interested to do that and get it to Beth so that I know what's going on, then we can see whether that type of fix is going to be possible and before we move this along.
Chair Hum, absolutely. We're happy to do that.
Let me get that.
Don't worry about
Representative Ben.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just found ORS 276.255, and I was looking at the state agency. It says here, shall may install or have installed not more than five locations these devices. And I guess that was a biennium. Are we still installing them, or have we stopped because we're having trouble recovering the cost of them?
Chair Hall, Representative Vince. No, that's not the case. We're still in the infancy of installing stations, and most agencies haven't put too many in. And while the law now says that we can only put in five locations, it doesn't limit how many stations we can put in at each location. So, for instance, if the Department of Administrative Services wanted to put in five chargers at one location and at each of the other five, we could do that if we needed to.
The obvious follow-up is, why would we put any in if we can't get our money back? But do you need further direction from us on how much we should subsidize, if at all, these stations? Or is this bill suggesting us any subsidy, I guess?
Chair, Representative Benz, it's suggesting that there could be some subsidy depending on the level of cost in order to install it. We're trying to foster the adoption and incorporate more vehicles into the state of Oregon. So our intention is to put stations where they're going to be cost effective to put in, as well as they're going to be used as much as we can foresee, and put them in high use areas.
And right. Well, the question again is, taking no position whatsoever on the desire to foster the use of electric cars, I simply want to know how much I'm paying for such an exercise. At what point will you get? Will you be able to share that with us?
Chair Helm, Representative Vince. So, for instance, we just put in some stations at the 550 building over on around the corner. That cost us about $12,000, I believe it was, to put in a charger for the public to use. That's generally how much it's going to cost.
Follow up. Yeah, per charger. We got one charger for $12,000. You get 22 chargers for $12,000. I just want to know how much we're spending and then how much we're getting back, so that space in between I would call a subsidy.
Right. Chair Helm, Representative. So, yes, that was for one charger with two units, so it could serve two vehicles at one time. And the way we've designed, tried to recover the cost, is over 20 years, which is the expected life of the unit. So spreading that cost out over that time frame and putting it into the cost of the charger and what we're charging people, without getting to be too exorbitant.
And if I could jump in, Chair Hellman, Representative Benz, if it would be helpful for the committee, we are happy to provide information and sort of a look at how much, where our charging stations are now, how many stations are at each location, how much it costs to put those there, and what the sort of average rate is for the end user to charge up at those stations, if that's helpful.
Very much so.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yes.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. And in addition to that information, your current utilization would be extremely useful, so we have some idea about that. I think the issue, and it is on the top of I think it's the second page, is finding a principle or a set of criteria to use to determine whether or not to put a charging station in. And I don't think you've articulated one yet. I think the policy question for us is the extent to which we want to allow DAS to subsidize these kinds of chargers. And I think that in getting to that answer, you have to sort of understand what the policy considerations are and how you would calculate not just the costs, but the public value of doing it. I mean, there's a couple of different issues there that I don't think are articulated very well, at least not in this statute. They might be in some other statute that I don't know about. Now, I admit, to some extent, everybody is kind of moving in the dark. We know, as a policy matter, at least I believe as a policy matter, we need to move toward a convenient charging system for people who drive electric cars, because that's something we absolutely have to have in order to reduce air pollution in Oregon. That has a value of some sort, and maybe that should be considered in electric vehicle charging, and maybe it shouldn't. At this point, I don't know. But I think at this stage, it's pretty difficult to simply say you can go out and figure out for yourself what you're going to charge for these things, which I think is what this bill does the way it's written. Without some sense of what the criteria are on which you will make that decision. And I don't think they've been articulated yet. Perhaps a bill redraft could start to articulate what the considerations are that would lead you to set a fee or a charge on charging that would be less than the actual recovery cost, recovery of costs. And I think that might be extremely helpful, and I hope that it sort of conforms to what Representative Polvey was getting at, because I certainly intended to add to that rather than add a new issue.
Any further comments? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The 20-year amortization or payback, is that statutorial? Is that determined by DAS? Is it kind of boilerplate in regards to agency recouping of costs?
Chair Helm, Representative Johnson. It's typical of what we look at when we're installing building features and other systems, of what the expected life cycle of that. Now, chargers are relatively new, but the components that they're made of are not. So that is our best estimate, that how long these units are going to last in the world.
Okay.
Representative Brocksmith.
Thank you. And I was going in the same direction, Representative Johnson. So the 20-year payback, don't you think that you might want to look at it in another philosophy, and that is not only do you want to pay for, you know, this charger, but you'd also want to bank the cost to replace it. So rather than looking at paying off this $12,000 over 20 years, I assume that charging stations might decrease in price in 20 years. We might not even have electric vehicles in 20 years. We could have other means of transportation by then. But my point is, and looking forward, so we aren't having this discussion again, and 20 years down the road, you already have the money to replace it. You won't have to come back to us to ask for it. If you were to pay it forward and not just recoup the 12 over 20, but actually bank the 12 within the 20.
Chair Helm, Representative Brocksmith, we can take that into consideration. One point I would like to make is that would add to the cost we would have to collect from the end users now over time. But that is something we could definitely work in.
Any further comments? Representative Barnhart.
I apologize for speaking again, but I just want to note that I'm a strong supporter of the concept. I really hope we can get to what you need in order to install a lot more electric vehicle chargers. So figure it out, and then let's do it.
Okay. On that note, I'll close the public hearing on 2330 and open a public hearing on 2331.
Mr. Chair and committee members, 2331. In 2010, the legislature enacted Senate Bill 1019, which authorized the Department of Administrative Services to sell, dispense, and distribute compressed natural gas to private entities. House Bill 2331 would extend the authorization to allow DAS to continue to sell CNG to private entities until January 2nd, 2025.
Go right ahead when you're ready.
Again, for the record, my name is Lindsay Baker, and I am the Government Relations Director at the Department of Administrative Services. As Beth just indicated, the timeline was 2010 session. We were authorized to provide CNG to the public. In the 2013 session, that sunset was extended to January of 2018. I think the expectation or the understanding perhaps was that at some point CNG fueling stations would be more prevalent and they would be more widely available to the public. To date, that still is not really the case. The closest two stations to Salem are in Springfield, Oregon, and in Lakewood, Washington. And so all we request is that the sunset be extended for another 7 years to July of 2025, 8 years, to July of 2025 until that gap is filled.
Questions from the committee? Representative Barnhart.
Is there a market for these facilities?
Chair Helm, Representative Barnhart, my understanding is that it's a relatively limited market. Oftentimes it's fleet. I think that there are some school districts perhaps that use it. I think Brian can maybe speak a little bit more to it. But I think that there's a small and slowly growing market.
Chair Helm, members of the committee, again, for the record, I'm Brian King, Fleet and Parking Services Manager for the Department of Administrative Services. Representative Barnhart, yes, there is a market. We do serve local area residents who have compressed natural gas vehicles, as well as some private entities such as ServiceMaster has some vehicles, and then companies that are transporting vehicles up and down the corridor for garbage trucks and other industries that are getting heavier into compressed natural gas stop off and top off on the way up.
That help? Mm-hmm. Representative Power.
This is a new concept to me. Can you explain to me why vehicles would use this type of fuel when it's otherwise not very available to them?
Chair Helm, Representative Powers, it is a very clean burning fuel, and it is also relatively inexpensive once you get the infrastructure in. So, for instance, right now, compressed natural gas is about $1.10 a gallon equivalent. So that is attractive to industries that are using heavier vehicles, especially like the garbage trucks. Daimler, Chrysler, and Freightliner have been heavily invested in developing trucks for the trucking industry for that purpose.
Thank you. Yeah.
Further questions? What does the facility look like? There are different models for how we either build or, in some cases, they're almost prefabricated stations for compressing natural gas and serving it. What do these look like?
Chair Helm, members of the committee, you're right. They vary greatly. They can be small units that a small operation can use to do a few vehicles to the one that we have, which is a large and can hold 3,000 gallon equivalents at one time. Mm-hmm. So depending on the operation, another big operation would be similar to the City of Salem's bus, the Chariots buses. They have a large facility as well. So it is all gamut of sizes and distribution types.
Very good. Thank you. Representative Betts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Of course, having brought one of the bills that may have resulted in this particular provision, I find it extremely interesting what happens with the passage of time. At the time we brought the bill, a liquid fuel cost about twice what it does today, mm-hmm. and so the savings for compressed natural gas was like $3 a gallon. I had a great good fortune of being able to attend the Lehigh Institute this summer and fall, and of course we learned there that we have 200 years supply of natural gas. Currently, liquid fuel is priced very low. Whether that will change or not is unknown. But if it did, compressed natural gas enjoys the ability to power heavy trucks. Electricity does not. And so the trick is to make sure that we're ready for whatever happens. As I learned, and as some of the lobbyists here in the room know, you want to have as many different sources of fuel available as you can. Otherwise, competition will and if you don't, competition won't work to our advantage. So having at least three different sources of these kinds of fuels is a very, very good thing for the state. That was the idea. But it is interesting. Nowadays, people have a very short memory when it comes to gasoline prices. Someday we may be very happy we have this available. So I'm in favor of the bill.
Okay. Any other comments, questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 2331. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2132 and invite up Sam Barrasso and Joe O'Donnell.
Thank you, Chair Helm, members of the committee. good afternoon. My name is Sam Barrasso, and I work in Multnomah County's Office of Sustainability. And I'm responsible for the development of Oregon's first commercial property assessed clean energy program. And the bill you have before you today is a tweak on that program that allows for additional measures to be eligible. The program was originally passed in 2009 with broad bipartisan support and amended in 2014 with additional broad bipartisan support. What it does, it allows local jurisdictions to support through use of a local improvement district type mechanism. It allows them to support the commercial, industrial, multifamily building owners with the financing of energy efficiency and renewable energy upgrades. And it does this in particular, the key element that it does this through is allows those building owners to access, in our instance, the way Multnomah County is operating the program, to access private capital, but repaid back through the property tax collection system. And in doing so, it gives greater security and helps these investments happen. And so what we're hoping to do in seeking this tweak is currently as the bill, as the statute and the program stand, they allow for energy efficiency and renewable energy upgrades. They do allow for water efficiency upgrades where there's a nexus with energy. So your low flow shower heads that reduce your hot water use and the natural gas usage there. But things that are solely water efficiency are not eligible as the program currently stands. And it's as we've started to roll out the program, it's been a big miss in the program. it's not often that you get a building owner's attention to do some of these key building resiliency upgrades. And as we have their attention, for us, we see it's really important to be able to bring water efficiency into the conversation, both from a resiliency perspective, but also utility perspective, because those are real costs and they help us do bigger, better projects in terms of these buildings. But as well, we're hoping to bring about within the program and enable energy storage, which isn't explicitly allowed, as well as electric vehicle charging stations. And for those are energy storage is you know, the economics are rapidly changing in terms of those becoming more feasible. And so we want to have it for building owners as the suite of options. Again, when we think about going into buildings and making those changes. So that is that's the key amendment. Those are the key amendments we're asking for. And then there's one other additional tweak in the bill that we're asking for. And what it does is, given that this mechanism uses what's very similar to local improvement districts, these have been around for a long, just to give some context, local improvement districts have been around for a long time, used to finance sidewalks, street lighting improvements, things that have a public-private benefit, as well as, you know, irrigation systems within irrigation districts. So they've been around for a long time, but in the way that local improvement districts typically function, they require board action and such because they're imposed. This program is voluntarily self-imposed by a property owner, and so the tweak we're looking for is to essentially remove some of that board action, which doesn't make sense in these programs and creates an onerous step. So those are the key changes we're asking for in this bill.
Joe, did you want to testify?
Chair Helm, Vice Chairs Johnson and Power, members of the committee, thank you for having me today. My name is Joe O'Donnell. I'm from a company called Ameresco. We are a leading efficiency renewable company serving North America. We've been pretty involved in CPACE programs across the nation, California, Minnesota, Texas, Colorado, and we're excited about the development of Oregon's PACE program. We think it's potentially a game changer for not just the industry, but the building owners throughout the community. Obviously, it reduces energy, it creates jobs, and it really opens up. If you think about the commercial marketplace for a second, you think about why projects like this wouldn't move forward. You usually had to have a two-year less payback. This allows building owners to go in and start doing deeper retrofits. One of the big things, though, that we've really noticed is that water is becoming the most, what I call, vital utility that's out there. If you talk to building owners, you look at cities, the cost of water continues to rise. And where we've seen CPACE programs be extremely effective is when we look at water efficiency. I'll give you an example. We, Ameresco, we've developed and are now constructing a $2.5 million project for Multnomah County. And a big portion of that is the most significant savings is the water. It represents about $500,000 worth of investment. And what that does, it's about 3.4-year payback. And what the water efficiency does, it helps, we talk about the power of the bundle. It helps pay for those longer payback items like boilers, chillers, mechanical equipment. So we think that it's a key component to a successful CPACE program, looking at the water efficiency. Regarding the energy storage and the UV stations, we kind of look at it like solar. Solar doesn't always look the best when it stands by itself, but when you combine it with energy efficiency and take a holistic approach to it, sometimes it will make sense financially. But from an industry standpoint, very, very excited about the CPACE program. Like to see more counties doing the same. So thank you for your time. Okay. Any questions?
Any questions? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate your presentation. How have you been interacting with or communicating with the utilities, I guess, as you talk about energy storage and so forth? And, of course, one of the issues that we encounter, i.e. in solar, in the residential capacity, is leads to net metering and so forth, where, you know, basically the folks are using the grid for a battery when the sun doesn't shine or whatever. But in terms of this, it would be taking it a little bit further, which is fine. But have you had conversations with the utilities, and have they commented on what you're proposing to do as you take this more to scale?
Representative Helm, Vice Chair Johnson. As part of the program, we've let the utilities know that operate within Multnomah County that we're operating the program, and some have engaged and asked questions, and so we've gone back and forth with a couple of utilities around how the program functions. As far as the specifics around how energy storage will work, and they haven't commented, and I think they haven't commented, and I think part of that is the program functions for property owners. So if a property owner wants to go through that, there's still an energy audit that needs to happen, and part of the economics that need to be played through in the energy audit, and Joe can speak to more, is figuring out whether that interconnections and how that actually functions with the utility and offsetting their various power bills. So that's something that happens on a project-by-project basis, but we haven't had the broader conversation with them.
Just to follow up, yeah, and my concern is not with the technology. I think it's great. It's just with the cost shifts that occur in the marketplace as we shift that cost to those who can't afford it, and those that can afford it, are able to invest and save money. So I'll just leave it at that. Thank you.
Sam, did you want to comment on that same thing? Did you want to comment on that question at all?
No, Chair Elm, I think.
Okay. Very good. Yeah. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm okay with the expansion of the types of activities that would fit within the PACE program. What I think we were discussing this morning is whether or not the device actually works, given the fact that you leapfrog over your existing mortgage to a position of priority. And that requires, of course, as the law is crafted, the consent of the mortgagee. And I just am curious how well it is working and how often the mortgagees are convinced to take that secondary position.
Within at least, as we've spoken to colleagues operating these programs in California and other states, I think there was a lot of learning in terms of when to and how to approach primary mortgage holders on these projects. What we're hearing now is, and I'm quoting this from a conference recently, and it's anecdotal, but folks are saying that they're getting, in about 60% of situations, they're getting primary mortgage holders to agree to the projects. I think that will vary widely on how those again, primary mortgage holders are engaged, how the actual project is constructed, and whether it has significant cash flow savings coming about it. But that's what we're hearing. And this is, the industry is relatively new. It's been about 5 years, and there's been something around $400 million or so done in commercial projects across the U.S. So that's I think that number will continue to go up as it gets more, as there's more experience around it.
And if I can just add, Chair Helm, members of the committee, it's all about having stories to tell, right? Being able to say where we've done it before and where it's working, and not being the first, not being the second, but getting stories out there in the community, whether it be here or other parts of the country, where PACE has worked. And with that comes the capital investment and the building owners that really want to start to look at deep retrofits and look holistically at some of their building stock.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. Could you say a little bit more about why a primary mortgagee would agree to take a subsidiary position, what the advantage, and maybe put it a different way, what the advantage of a bank or some other mortgagee doing that would be? Why would they agree to that?
Chair Helm, Representative Barnhart. With these bundled investments, they're done in a way, and they should be done in a way that you have greater savings, annual savings than your payback over the investment, over the course of the life of the investment. And so what this does for a primary mortgage holder is it improves the underlying value of the asset, because first it improves it. I mean, you get better features in the building, better windows, better HVAC system, solar panels, what have you. But then also from a building owner perspective, and it improves the building owner's ability to pay back that underlying mortgage, because they have more cash flows at the end of the year because they're saving more on their utility bills. So it improves from their portfolio. It decreases the risk of that individual defaulting on that mortgage, and it also improves the underlying asset value.
Could I follow up?
Yeah.
Rents are higher and costs are lower. Is that a reasonable interpretation of what you just said?
Representative Helm, Chair Representative Barnhart. The utility costs as a result of taking on these improvements will decrease, and the assumption in designing these programs is the assessment that you pay annually is lower than you get a greater utility decrease than the assessment you pay, so on the net you end up saving money. So I'm not sure I said that.
No, I think I got that part. If I could follow up.
Follow up.
The other piece, I suspect a building built in the 50s that's now got new sashes and new insulation, and we've added some solar panels on the roof, and maybe we redid the lobby, and probably replaced some of the plumbing, is going to be worth more to a tenant, and therefore they're willing to pay higher rent. Or at least you may get a mix of tenants that are willing to pay higher rent. Did I misunderstand that in some way?
That's correct. Chair Helm, Representative Barnhart, that's exactly correct. Look at it like a triple net lease, if you will, for a second, and making improvements into a building, like you just mentioned, mm-hmm. and then being able to reevaluate that and assess that to prospective renters or people that are leasing the building space.
And then the final follow-up, if I may, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Why do we need a public finance mechanism for this kind of thing if it's such a good deal for the building owner and the primary mortgagee? Why would we need to do that?
Chair Helm, Representative Barnhart. Over time, the hope is that we don't. Right now, well, we don't have those. We don't have long-term. We don't have financing that goes out 20 years. And where you have measures that take 20 years to pay back, we have financing on commercial. You know, we have commercial financing that has a balloon payment at year 10. And so there just isn't fixed interest amortized over 20-year terms in terms of in this sector. So I think over time, the hope is that these sort of programs prove it up and prove the risk, and you start seeing lenders developing these sort of products. But at the moment, this is what we have to fill this niche.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I'm hoping that we're going to hear from people who approve these kinds of arrangements, either from the department or from the government entities other government entities that approve them. At this point,
can you answer?
Yeah.
This program, I think, Multnomah County is the only county that has taken advantage of the statute.
That may explain why I don't know anything about it.
Yeah.
Yes, Chair Helm, Representative Barnhart. Multnomah County is the first county to move forward on this. We've been in conversations with Lane County as well as Washington County about the program, and as well as Deschutes County. But a lot of folks are essentially sitting back and saying, all right, let's see how it works for the county, and then we'll be interested afterwards. And what we're developing, largely because we've been adapting the program to function within Oregon statutes, we're hoping that it's going to be other counties can carbon copy our program and take them there.
Right. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks.
Yes. Representative Fulvey.
I hate to drag this conversation out, but it's fascinating. Am I correct that the local government is making the loan, or a private entity could make the loan, and it's an either-or situation?
Representative Chair Helm, Representative Holvey, as the statute is written, local governments can bond and make those loans to those individuals. In our program, and there's broad flexibility in terms of how local governments design their programs. In the current statute, we've designed our program so that private capital providers can lend for the property owners.
And a follow-up, I'm not sure this is a question. But I can understand if the local government is making the loan, back to Representative Bent's comments about the lien position of the government, being prior to the mortgage loan and taking precedence over that. But if a private entity is making that loan, it seems like it would necessitate it to be secondary to that mortgage loan. Is there... I don't know.
Chair Helm, Representative Holvey, the check to that is that within the program, as the statute is written, we do the primary mortgage holder must give consent for the private capital provider to move ahead in this particular lien position. So the price. So there is a conversation. The primary mortgage holder says, "Yes, I'm okay with you moving ahead in front of me." And I think that was exactly the reason is because it was that there needed to be that conversation and that consent had to be given.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Representative Benz.
Oh, at the risk of piling on, Mr. Chair, I was going to mention what Representative Holy said, and that is whoever makes the loan is going to be on first base, mm-hmm. I think only second only to the real property taxes. So the risk being taken by local government is pretty small. The mm-hmm. the real question mm-hmm. is the second position, why they would ever do it, and that takes us back to Representative Barnhart's remarks. And so I would be. It's going to be very interesting. I'm not surprised it's not being used very much, but the need for some of the things that are on this list pretty great. Yeah. So if the need isn't being met with other devices, then perhaps this one will work. Mm-hmm. And as I mentioned to you when we met there earlier today, watching 400 or 500 buildings fall down in my district reminds one of the fact we may have an earthquake someday. Yeah. And boy, is that a bad deal. And so to the extent that we can retrofit buildings, if this program works, well, hooray. And it looked to me like the risk was modest for the public entity.
Yeah.
If I've said something wrong, tell me.
That's right.
Yeah. Representative Holby.
Were you in a hurry? Yeah.
Unfortunately, today we have an abundance of time.
Well, thanks. I thank you for the consideration. But I'm kind of curious how the program works and how many of these loans under your program are being made by the local government versus private entities. That would be very interesting to know, because if the loans are being made by a private entity, and it just seems like it's hard for me to envision that a mortgage lender would agree to take a secondary position, and it seems like a change in the program to in that case the utility improvement would take a second position behind that mortgage would make the program much more used in the situation where the private entity is making the loan instead of the local government. Did that make sense? Yeah. Anyway, I think that made sense. So anyway, I would like some information about how many times private entities are making the loans versus local government is actually making the loan.
Chair Helm, Representative Holby, I can get some of that information to you after this. Specifically, what I can say is, as far as our program, we're just launching this month. So we'll be learning as far as locally.
Okay, well.
But I can bring information based on what has happened in other states. What I can say anecdotally, and beyond anecdotally, a lot of conversations, is that it's primarily private capital providers that are funding these projects. Connecticut's program, which was the first out of the gate, which has had about it's almost closed about $100 million in deals so far, so the bulk of them. And majority of those were initially they were originated through the Connecticut's Green Bank, but they were ultimately securitized by private folks.
Yeah. Yeah. Seems odd to me. But
one more, and then I'm going to release these fellows.
Thank you.
Representative Bonner.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I'm coming to understand what this thing does, it seems to me that it's likely to be self-limiting. If a project works for the owner and it works to be moved to the second position for the mortgagee, based on their analysis of the financing and the outcome, then it probably works. If any of those things don't happen, then it isn't going to occur. What have I missed?
Chair Helm, Representative Barnhart, you've got it right. And then secondly, unless there is no primary mortgage holder, and then that well, makes it then great.
Thank you. Thank you,
but you've got it right. Correct.
Thank you. And I. Thank you both very much for being here and answering our questions. I would note that this same at the Lehigh conference that I attended a couple of years ago, we had, I believe, a session on PACE, and then NCSL has had sessions on PACE. Around the country, places with a longer track record have shown this to be extremely useful and is primarily private capital driven. So I'm going to keep the committee here for one more person to testify. I'm going to let you folks go and invite Megan Beyer up.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that will be our public testimony for today.
We need. I didn't know anything about this.
And there's a lot out there.
But I'm getting it.
Yeah. It's a, I want to move it to residential, too. Go right ahead.
Hi, good afternoon. For the record, or Chair Helm, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Megan Beyer, and I'm here representing the electricians of IBEW, the local 16 sheet metal workers, and the sheet metal contractors, the UA local 290 plumbers and steam fitters, and the plumbing contractors in support of this bill. Our members have actually been involved in this the legislation back in 2009, and have been involved in the planning and implementation of this program in Multnomah County, and are eagerly awaiting the ability to add some of these measures into the program. As we all know, our infrastructure is aging and very inefficient, and including a number of our buildings. And this program just enables our property owners and building owners to do some financing options that will address the resiliency and efficiency in these buildings. And we believe that these measures will not only address some of the climate goals our communities have set, as well as bringing some potential cost savings to these building owners. And finally, these changes may lead to potential work for our members, and we represent a highly trained workforce that is ready and willing to get to work on the projects. So thank you for your time, and we urge your support.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Any questions, committee members? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2132, and that's the last order of business today. The House Committee on Energy and Environment is adjourned. Committee on Energy and Environment is adjourned.